information where unknown forces strike the edge of ecology.
Can you hear me too? Without the microphone, or would you prefer with the microphone?
Without.
With. Without, without, okay, halfway.
Stick it in your
hold it here. Actually, it works for me because I don't have to shout. And is anybody else suffering from a prolonged cough? Yeah? No? Yeah? Oh, yeah, I've had this damn thing since just after Christmas, and it seemed to kick off when the chemtrails were kicking in, you know, and these chemtrails started coming over in circles. The damn plane started literally circling. This is South Devon. Unbelievable. Unbelievable, but, you know, hey, hopefully that, you know, that it's becoming so obvious. And I found an app. I found an app on that somebody has sent me a link to, and I'm going to put it out as far as I can, because this app is for louder. It is for tracking planes, so you can literally see who's flying over or what planes are flying over a given area. So if you see a chemtrail being laid over an area, you can literally look into this app and see what planes are supposed to be flying over your area at that given time. And of course, those people who have been using this so far have pretty much discovered that the planes that are spraying out this crap aren't on the air traffic control log. And the Worcester Press, the Worcester local press, last Saturday ran an article about an unidentified plane. They actually had a photograph of it with this outrageous chemtrail coming out the back. And there was just the speculation. Instead of speculating what it was spraying, they were speculating on what the plane was, because it was an unidentified plane. And this is the local paper basically saying that this plane is unregistered, it wasn't on any air traffic control, and when they contacted air traffic control, they couldn't identify it. And so they were speculating that it was a US Air Force plane flying out of Mildenhall. But air traffic control supposedly had no record of it. So anyway, hopefully what's going on, you know, we'll get more and more people to start to look up and take note of what's being sprayed. And before I get into the talk proper, let me introduce you to those who haven't come across it before, Uncensored magazine. I came across this magazine when I was in New Zealand three months ago. And I met with the editor, and I had never heard of this magazine, but it has quite a large circulation in Australia and New Zealand. But it hadn't really come across to Europe, which wasn't too surprising, because obviously with the shipping charges, it was tripling the cost of the magazine. Anyway, the editor gave me a few back issues to read while I was traveling around, and when I read them and I came back to the UK, I thought, you know, we really need something like this here. So I cut a deal with the editor and the owner of the magazine. So this is the first edition printed in Europe. So this will now be a quarterly magazine printed in Lithuania, because I couldn't get it printed in the UK, tragically, for any and still make it viable, which means that we have to ship it, unfortunately. But nonetheless, as you can see at the back there, are quarterly magazines. This is a quarterly publication. So they're $4.99 for a single copy, or an annual subscription, including postage, if you take one with you tonight, it's $27.50. And if you sign up for an annual subscription for it, I put up a couple of hundred of this DVD, which is actually the DVD of a presentation I gave last year, very shortly after the Norway massacre. And it's the shift is about to hit the fan. And so that's free if you take an annual subscription. And still on the plugging before we get on the talk, I did a series of workshops last year called The Shift is About to Hit the Fan, which were quite well received. In fact, I had a lot of emails from people asking me to do more, and how come it was only one day, why couldn't it be two? You can't please all the people all the time, can you? Anyway, I put together a schedule. So I'm doing a series of workshops starting in London the last weekend in February, and then literally covering the country and Ireland over the next 12 weeks or so. And this is called Shift 2, the next level. So there's some flyers at the back if you're interested, because I'm actually bringing it to Eastbourne and Portsmouth on the south coast, trying to spread. I think I'm doing Exeter, Portsmouth and Eastbourne. So trying to get to within reach of as many people as possible. So thanks for coming out tonight. This is my first talk of 2012, And does anybody here think 2012 is just going to be another year?
No.
Oh, no.
Anyway, I don't think so. One way or another, this is going to be an incredibly memorable year. I mean, 2011 was memorable, and yet most people have actually forgotten most of the stuff that occurred in 2011. You know, when I first started giving talks, which is almost 10 years ago now, generally there was, you know, just one or two issues to talk about. Although I was talking a lot about what was going to happen because, you know, I'd read the scripts, but trying to get people to comprehend that these events were documented and were going to happen in 2003 and 2004, when supposedly the world was in the grip of an economic boom. You know, I was regarded as the harbinger of doom. But of course, what's happened over the last few years is everything that I was talking about in 2000, and well, certainly 2005, I can say, because it's documented through DVDs. But 2005, 2006, 2007, 2008, everything that I and many others, of course, were talking about at that time has unfortunately come to pass. And I and most of the others don't claim any special insight. We simply read the scripts. It's all out there. I mean, these guys who perpetrate this agenda, they are so arrogant. They are so arrogant, and they actually believe, and I won't make a comment, they actually believe that humanity is so dumbed down that they can spell it out in words of one syllable, and the vast majority of people will just simply ignore it. But of course, they've created the construct to help people ignore it, because they keep people locked in to the left brain construct, as I call it, the rat race, the world of TikTok. Keep people locked into doing, to chasing the dollar, to keeping food on the table, roof over their head, so they actually don't have time to take account of what's going on in the wider realm. But of course, over the last 2 or 3 years now, more and more people have started to realize that things aren't quite the way they're cracked up to be. And more people are starting to either feel it directly or indirectly in terms of a family member or somebody else in their extended family or somebody that they know. I mean, let me just ask a question. How many people here are in a situation where you know that you either have somebody in your family or you know somebody that is either unemployed or underemployed or struggling to literally keep a roof over their head and food on the table? Okay, I lumped all three together so that, you know, it didn't get too personal. So there's pretty much everybody in the room, and that's pretty much the case, of course, wherever we go around the country. We don't have to go too far along the coast. Yeah, you know, we get to some of the outskirts of Portsmouth, and we're talking 40% plus unemployment. You know, we're talking areas of the country where there are 35% of the stores boarded up. And of course, each week we're hearing about new businesses basically going bust. You know, in the high street, it's called Peacocks, it's the last one to go. So before I get underway with the talk proper, let's just take a look at what's really going on. And it's incredible. I mean, literally, I'm going to spend just 15 minutes or so just talking about stuff that's been in the media for the last 2 days. And this is the arrogance, because this stuff is in the media. It's there for people to see what's going on. And most people scan the paper because it's mindscaping. The mainstream media mindscapes. It sort of basically creates a picture of normality. And you go, oh yeah. Oh yeah, oh yeah, oh yeah, oh yeah. And then get on with your work, or whatever. But let's just take a look at a few things that have occurred over the last few days. Of course, we had to, I mean, this was so predictable. Not necessarily that they were going to go rescue the hostages, but it was the State of the Union address. This was potentially Obama's last, it's certainly the last State of the Union address in this term of his presidential office. I mean, if he gets re-elected, of course, then he'll get another 4 opportunities. But the State of the Union. So what's he going to talk about in the State of the Union? The fact that America's going to shit? The fact that unemployment is reaching record levels in the US. The fact that tent cities are growing. No. They have to create the Hollywood event so that in the State of the Union he can brag about, you know, how yet again the men of SEAL Team 6 have been in and saved these hostages. And this was brilliant, wasn't it? Hostages are saved by men who killed Bin Laden. Well, somebody who wrote that headline obviously forgot that actually last year, SEAL Team 6, the team that supposedly murdered or assassinated Bin Laden last May, actually all died in a helicopter crash in Afghanistan. And of course, the reason they all had to die, I mean, they didn't die because they didn't exist in the first place, but the reason they had to die, as far as the mainstream media was concerned, because the whole Osama Bin Laden event of last May was a total crock of crap. It didn't happen. It was a construct. It was actually a construct to get a whole bunch of other stuff off of the front pages of the press in the US. So, of course, as far as George Bush's administration was concerned, the vast majority of people in George Bush's administration actually believed that Osama bin Laden was dead before the end of 2001. So here we were last May, where Osama bin Laden was being murdered for what was supposedly about the third time. But it was part of the construct. But anyway, here we go again. State of the Union address. The night before the State of the Union address, Osama is greeted in Congress to rapturous applause, standing ovation, because of this event. I mean, it is just unbelievable. Was this today's paper? The US hits the pirates. SEALs team kills nines arrested. And of course, it's all over the front pages in the US. Everything else is knocked off. And it's conveniently forgotten that SEAL Team 6, tragically, died in a helicopter crash in Afghanistan. Which meant that, of course, there's nobody left alive who was supposedly part of the operation to nail Osama bin Laden. Very convenient.
Do you think bin Laden's still alive?
Is he still alive?
Does he exist?
Oh, who knows? Go and ask Elvis. Meanwhile, of course, you know, here in the UK, you know, or in Europe, we got the recession looming as tensions rise in the EU. Yeah, Merkel raises new fears about the future of Greece. Brilliant! Brilliant. Where has she been for the last 3 years? I mean, this is just what is so outrageous. I mean, if there is anybody now who still believes that the global financial meltdown is an unfortunate series of random events, you know, really is living in a delusional cuckoo world. If there was any desire to break this cycle of events, there have been multiple opportunities right from the get-go. There is no desire to break this, as we're going to see as we go through. So what we've seen today all through the media is Angela Merkel basically is preparing the ground within the EU for Greece to either appear to take the decision to leave the Eurozone or be kicked out, basically, which basically means that Greece has been fleeced. It means that there's nothing left.
The golden fleece has disappeared.
Absolutely. They've literally stripped everything. I mean, this is what is going on right now. It is a game of global asset stripping. And let me tell you, I mean, we here have no real comprehension of the magnitude of the problems that are occurring in Greece. The only reason that Greece is basically surviving, if you like, is because of the culture of Greece, which is very much still around the extended family. That Mediterranean culture. I mean, if that same situation was occurring, say, in the UK, it would be a very, very different ballgame because we've lost that connect with the extended family. So what you've got in Greece is literally people getting together, not just as extended families, but as communities. And literally operating outside of the system. And what we've got going on in Greece right now is very similar to what was occurring in the Soviet Union prior to the collapse of the Soviet Empire in the late 80s. Nobody in Greece is paying taxes. Nobody. The only people that are paying taxes are the civil servants, because the government actually deducts it from their money before it gives it to them. But to actually keep employees on, because the most employers actually can't afford to pay their employees, so what they're doing is they're saying to their employees, okay, you have to be responsible for your taxes, knowing damn well that the employees aren't going to pay the taxes. So what we've got going on here is the country, of course, is descending further and further into bankruptcy. So the only solution, ultimately, is for Greece to drop out of the Eurozone and re-establish its own currency. But the critical factor is that it has to re-establish that currency as the People's Bank of Greece and not as a Rothschild's bank, where you have the central bankers issuing the money, as they do everywhere else, issuing the money, and then, of course, charging interest on it. And, you know, what's going on in Greece, by the way, the situation is not dissimilar in Ireland, Portugal, Spain, and Italy's not far behind, and France is now, you know, going down that track. And yet, there is no political or financial community incentive to do anything different. It's literally just a question of going down this path until they have asset stripped everything they can out of the country. Greek rescue not working. It was never intended to work. Never intended to work. None of the rescue plans are intended to work. You know, what we got is a crazy situation. The European Central Bank is requesting money from solvent governments so that the European Central Bank can loan the money that it is effectively given from solvent countries, that it can loan the money to banks that have gone bust, so that those banks can then once again create money out of thin air through the fractional reserve banking system and loan it back to governments that have already proven that they can't pay their existing debts. I mean, if you or I tried to do something like that, we'd be in jail for fraud. But, you know, the financial community and the political community are just keeping on trucking. This guy, I mean, I said, you know, 4 years ago that Gordon Brown would never be permitted to win an election. That this guy was being groomed to take the UK into the next stage of the game, which is to play the role of appearing to be leading the British people through a tough time, but in reality what he's doing is digging the hole deeper. His problem is that more and more people are starting to realise that this is exactly what he's doing, and that he is not making any effort, he and most other politicians around the world, not making any effort to literally dig out the cancer, which is the fractional reserve banking system. Until the fractional reserve banking system is shut down, the situation that we're in is just going to get worse and worse and worse, and until literally everything is fleeced and there's nothing left. So what we're going to see is this multiple blame game going on. Osborne blames the Eurozone as Citi fears the double dip. Yeah, well, great, blame the Eurozone. You know, of course...
they've also got Clegg indicating that Osborne has made the cuts too imminent in regards to what's...
Well, you know, the cuts are irrelevant. Anyway, you know, I mean, basically, with the austerity, of course, is just a question of... It's just an attempt to try and get the message across that we're in a world of hurt. But these guys don't even begin to comprehend the term austerity. It doesn't apply to them. You know, the austerity applies at the lower end, the lowest end of the social strata. These guys don't even begin to feel the first pinch of it. But recently, of course, Cameron got a lot of good press because he stood up to the Eurozone and wouldn't buy in to the constraints that they wanted to put on the financial community. Now, whilst I certainly wouldn't condone signing over any nation, I wouldn't condone any nation signing over the control of their economy to any outside agency, not least the European Central Bank. But in this case, what Cameron was actually doing was simply responding to the instruction that he'd been given by the British financial sector, which was, we can't operate with those constraints, or we're not going to operate with those constraints. So Cameron's actually, not only has he basically said, okay, you know, well, you guys go do what you want in the Eurozone, because we're not going to play ball, but we're also not going to put any constraints whatsoever on the casino mentality within the city banking system. This is where we get told exactly what's happening. Families and pensioners slipping deeper and deeper and deeper into the red. You know, the only country on the planet right now in the developed world that thinks it's escaped the recession is Australia. And they are being set up for a massive, massive collapse later this year. The only reason that the Australians think that they've escaped the recession is because the banks haven't started calling in the credit. What's happening in Australia is basically people saying, you need money? How much do you need? Here it is. Just, you know, ramp up. Here's another credit card. So right now, Australians have the highest level of personal debt of any developed nation on the planet. And when the rug is pulled from under them, as it will be later this year, then they're really going to feel the pinch in a big way. But, you know, what we've got in the situation right now, we've got private pensions being decimated. So people that were paying into pension plans for 35, 40 years, especially people thinking that they were buying in or participating in a final salary benefit scheme, which would give them a pension of 2/3 of their final salary on top of their state pension, so therefore they'd be able to effectively live in the lifestyle to which they've become accustomed. Those pensions are being decimated. Those funds have been ripped apart by the financial community. And the actuaries who are responsible for effectively guiding the pension trustees and telling them how to protect the investments to make sure that the pension funds can provide for all the liabilities should be facing criminal charges. But you know, what we do is we focus on people at the bottom end. We focus on people stealing a loaf of bread because they can't feed their families. You know, as opposed to the bankers who have fleeced the nation, and of course we're giving them out outrageous bonuses as well. You know, so I mean, look at this. On average, there will be £260 a month, a fifth of monthly pension going just to pay debts. And of course, for a lot of people, it's a lot more than that. And here's the first clue that the price of gold is about to ramp up another notch. Anytime you see any mention that money is going to be pumped into the economy, it means the price of gold is going to go up. Because ultimately, currency is backed by something, it's backed by gold. So that's why I'm going to look at the price of gold a little bit later. But that's why you're going to see gold now ramp up and probably get up to $2,500 an ounce by later this year, back end of this year. Because as you're going to see, towards the back end of this year, the game is going to ramp up to another level in a big way. And as the debt hits a trillion, no way. The debt's way over 4 trillion. Way over. This is only what he's admitted. But I think it was 3 years ago, it was admitted that the debt was 3.4 trillion, and now it's way over 4. And now, of course, coupled with that, you know, we've got this bullshit of a refinery
going broke.
How convenient. How convenient. And, of course, the local gas stations were jumping on the bandwagon. I mean, I was driving across from Devon, and the number of gas stations where diesel was 145, 146, it was motorway prices in some of the chains, like Sainsbury's and Tesco's. And this is just rampant profiteering, taking advantage because they think people will pay it. And of course, we've got a crazy situation where our government rushes to bail out a bank. And yet here, you know, a prime contributor to keeping our economy, which unfortunately, of course, is oil dependent, moving, and they can't find the funds to do it. I mean, it will come back on stream, of course, but you know, not before the test to see how much the British people will pay. Because this is an attempt to fleece, because, you know, the reality is, of that £7 a gallon, well, let's talk in the price per litre, of £1.40 a litre, how much of that is actually the cost of the oil? Anybody got an idea?
10p.
It's a little bit more.
60p?
Yeah, 60p. Yeah, from upstream, yeah. From actually getting it out of the ground, right through until it gets in the pump, 60p. The rest is tax. The rest is tax. Now have a look at what's going wrong here. So we've got a crazy situation where Western governments in particular are making more in tax revenues than they've ever made before, but the debt is getting bigger. Of course it doesn't add up. It's not meant to add up. And of course we're all being geared up for what's coming here with Iran. So look at, you know, elected politicians, elected to represent the interests of their constituents and the interests of the British people. And yet we've got politicians that literally choose to completely ignore the obvious solution to getting out of the current financial mess. And this isn't rocket science. We're not talking about something that's in the land of the fairies. We just need to look at Iceland. And we just need to look at the Icelandic experience, where basically they told the banks, sorry, you created the problem, it's your problem, you deal with it, we're not going to take the responsibility of the casino-style banking system adopted by the Icelandic banks, we're not going to have the taxpayer underwrite it. You created the problem, you deal with it, you've got bondholders to deal with, go deal with them, they are not the responsibility of the taxpayer. And when the Icelandic government fell and the new government came in, it was ostensibly women that came into the positions of power, the saving grace for them was that they knew nothing about banking. But they knew basic budgeting. And they had a lot of help. And of course the first thing they did was effectively create the People's Bank of Iceland. So they got rid of the Rothschilds fractional reserve banking system and started issuing their own currency and putting Icelandic people's krona into the economy. So it was money going into the economy in return for work or services, but nobody owed interest on it. So here we are just after, 3 years, almost exactly 3 years, since the Icelandic economy went into absolute total meltdown, and they're well on the road to recovery. Now, of course, admittedly, it's a lot easier to do it with 300,000 people than it is with 55, 60 million. But hey, you know, from a basic template, you can build. So here we've got their next ramp up. You know, we haven't got any money to pay for basic services, and we're going to have to force austerity across the lower levels of society, but we can find the money to launch a war with a country that hasn't attacked anybody again. So here we go, for the third time in a decade, or at least the third time, you know, we're not even going to get into the sort of Bosnia and the Somalias and everywhere else, but here we go, for the third time fourth time in a decade, Iraq, Afghanistan, well, let's put it in chronological order, Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, and now Iran. And the goal is the same in all of them. Well, Afghanistan, the goal was opium. But with Iraq and Libya and now Iran, of course, the goal is control of the oil.
But Iran's got huge supplies of opium as well.
Say again?
Iran has huge supplies of opium as well, apparently more than Afghanistan.
Well, possibly. I mean, Iran is a massive country. I mean, this is the other thing. People don't realise the scale of Iran. I mean, it's four times the size of Iraq, and the topography of Iran is much more similar to Afghanistan than it is Iraq. I mean, Iraq is much more desert, Afghanistan, of course, is much more mountainous. And in terms of Iran, has far more mountainous terrain than it does desert. Plus, it's a nation of 60 million people. And the Persian people are a very proud people.
I think the nail in the coffin end for Iran is that they've moved away from the petrodollar.
Well, they moved away a number of years ago, but it was always going to be the nail in the coffin. I mean, it was the nail in the coffin, of course, for Gaddafi. Well, it's the nail in the coffin for Saddam. I mean, Saddam took the Iraqi oil away from the petrodollar the moment that the Supreme Court awarded the election to George W. Bush in back end of 2000. And when the, you remember the iconic shot of George W. Bush giving his victory speech on board the USS, the aircraft carrier, with it in the background was mission accomplished. All right, and the vast majority of people thought mission accomplished meant that this was the end of the military campaign getting to Baghdad. Mission accomplished had nothing at all to do with the military campaign. That statement, mission accomplished, was a statement to the financial community that from this moment forward, Iraqi oil was once again being traded in petrodollar. And in the period between November of 2000 and, what was that, May 2003, in that period, the US dollar had fallen by 20% against currencies like the euro and the yen, because these currencies were obviously, you know, being accepted by Iraq, which was, you know, even though it was only allowed to sell oil for food, I think it was selling about 600,000 barrels a day or so, but it was a fair chunk of change. And of course, Gaddafi's crime was not only to state that he was intending to establish an Arab-African economic union, but to base it around the gold dinar and away from the fake petrodollar. And of course, all of these countries that have been labelled as the axis of evil by the Western media, all have one thing in common. And that one thing that they have in common is that they are all free of the Rothschilds banking system, or were. They all retained responsibility for the production of an issuance of money within their borders. So they were issuing money without it being debt. It was money put into the economy to fuel the economy, to feed the economy, keep the wheels of the economy turning without there being the burden of debt on it. So funnily enough, how many countries do you think we have left in the world that still have responsibility for controlling their own currencies?
Three.
Go on, which are, who are they?
Cuba,
Iran, North Korea. Okay, and then we also have Russia and China. So, I mean, but they're outside of the equation right now. We might talk a bit about them in a little while later, because I think there's going to be something that may occur later this year as well, which may upset that particular apple cart. So, you know, be prepared here. We really need to get ourselves into a situation where people do not accept this. Do you remember what happened in the run-up to Tony Blair and George Bush's attack on Iraq?
Yeah.
What happened? Millions of people, all over the world, hit the streets to protest against the attack on the sovereign nation of Iraq, which had nothing at all to do with 9/11, but of course, you know, the tenuous link was being built up in the US media. But the vast majority of people knew that this had nothing at all to do with 9/11 and was simply a colonial grab. And these were people who hadn't even read the scripts. You know, read Zbigniew Brzezinski's book, The Grand Chessboard, which he published in 1997, or the neocon document, Rebuilding America's Defenses, which was published in September of 2000. And 10 of the 27 signatories to that document went straight into George Bush's government when he was sworn in on the White House lawn in January of 2001, just 5 months after the document was published. Millions of people hit the streets all over the world. What difference did it make?
No.
Exactly. This was the global elite effectively letting it be known through their puppets of George Bush and Tony Blair that it didn't matter a damn that people were going to vote with their feet and hit the streets, because it was going to be a one-day vote, a one-day protest. Everyone was going to feel that they'd done their bit, and then they'd go home. And on Monday morning, everything would be back to normal. And that, unfortunately, was exactly the case. They were proven to be absolutely correct. And this is what basically gave them the confidence then to just pursue their agenda and accelerate the timescales. Because they know that if they can keep the vast majority of people in a position of borderline poverty, where they've got to spend or feel they've got to spend pretty much every damn working minute chasing the money to be able to feed their families or keep a roof over their heads, then they can keep them distanced from the political arena. And they can get away with whatever the hell they want to get away with. The Occupy movement, in theory, everyone here has heard of the Occupy movement, yeah? In theory, here was a movement that had enormous potential. It was ostensibly a disaffected youth, right across the planet, almost, certainly in the developed world, the disaffected youth, and by this I'm going to use the definition of under 35. There were many exceptions to prove the rule. In fact, in the Totnes Occupy movement, I don't think there was anybody under 70 in there. So there were exceptions. But the vast majority and the main thrust of the Occupy movement was the disaffected under 35s. And in reality, although Occupy Wall Street is given the credit as kicking the movement off, in reality it really kicked off in Spain last May, where tens of thousands of young people are still camping out in the city squares and town squares all around Spain because they have no work and no prospect of work. And the great tragedy is they have no idea how to get themselves out of the problem. So they're actually desperately saying to their government, look, please, please, we haven't got a clue how to resolve this ourselves. We need you to help us. Think about it. This is a very, very sad reflection on our under 35s. Globally. But it's no accident. It's no accident. These under 35s, and again, there are many, many exceptions. These under 35s are a product of a deliberate dumbing down process. But as part of that process as well, what it's also happened is what we have, particularly with the under 35s, and we'll talk a little bit about this in the second half of the evening. With the under 35s, we have this inflated sense of self, inflated sense of ego. And I'm not being derogatory here, I'm not being demeaning, because it is something you grow out of if you're under 35, or maybe you've grown out of it already. I'll tell you, because I was exactly the same. The difference was that in our youth, there was never the possibility that we were going to be unemployed. It was never a possibility. In fact, I mean, really, it just came down to how many interviews we could be asked to make the effort to go to before we decided which job we were going to take. And that was a situation with a few sort of minor hiccups that occurred, you know, pretty much right through to about the mid-80s. And then we started to sort of go into the slippery slope. There were periods, good years and bad years. But up until probably the second term of Thatcher, we pretty much, in the post-war years, had full employment in this country. And there was never going to be an issue with the under 35s, or any particular age group, being disaffected. But today, what the Occupy movement has shown, and I visited the Occupy movement in London, in Sydney, and in Wellington, and in Dunedin. And like I said, there are exceptions that prove the rule, but I'm going to be very generic and I'm going to share with you what I saw. Basically, I saw a bunch of people sitting around getting drunk on Carlsberg Special Brew or stoned. And when I was saying to them, so, you know, what are you guys doing? What's the plan? You want some weed, man? It's like, okay, guys, you know, what's the plan? What do you hope to be doing, say, in 3 months' time? You know, when I said to them, guys, is there anybody here who's coordinating maybe a blog? I'm sure this is something you guys are more familiar with than me. What about a blog or coordinating between the various Occupy movements to get information out, to share information? And then I was told they had to go, I can't remember the name, but they were all going off to a particular meeting. And I followed along to this meeting and I realized that the whole of the Occupy movement had been infiltrated and was basically controlled opposition. And then what did I see yesterday or the day before? George Soros, with a smile on his face, said the Occupy movement's going to become violent. Well, he should know. Because I don't think he's too far away from the manipulators behind the scene here. You know, once again, what we're seeing here is the experiment. What we are unfortunately seeing with the Occupy movement is the inability of the disaffected youth to get themselves organized in any way, shape, or form. Even if there was a game plan to say, okay, you know, tomorrow we're going to hit this bank, or tomorrow we're going to, the day after, we're going to hit this particular politician. It was just roll on, wake up in the tent, sit around, have breakfast, can of Carlsberg Special Brew, and the next joint. And those who are driving this agenda go, brilliant. They're no problem then. People who have retired, we shouldn't expect them to be taking too much of an active role in what's going on now. Fortunately, many, many are. But we shouldn't necessarily expect these people have, you know, given their service to the community. They've given their service to the country in many, many different ways, and they should be now enjoying their pension. But of course, unfortunately, in many cases, that pension's being ripped away. The onus is going to be, and has been, I think, for a number of years, but the onus is really going to be on the 35 through to, let's say, 70 age group. You know, those people who have known what it's like to enjoy full employment, those people that have known what it's like to literally enjoy a society that has cohesion, coherence, and has seen this descent into whatever we want to call it today. You know, individually, every nation on the planet is made up of good people. You know, go to an airport, any airport, anywhere in the world, and just go to the arrivals area there, and look at the love that you see of people greeting family members as they come back from their travels, wherever that may be. I've never yet been to an airport anywhere in the world where there's aggression at the arrivals hall. Aggression is not really part of our natural human makeup. It's being created. It's being driven. Now, this is interesting because apparently we're going to start a war with Iran, but we've got no military personnel. And somehow I don't think that the bureaucrats are going to be getting in line to go and get into the front line. You know, what we've got to get to here is, I mean, the likes of William Hague, I mean, that guy, you know, very few people have the capability to raise the hairs on the back of my neck. But William Hague seems to be able to do it without trying. And here we've got a guy who is a committed Zionist, states categorically that his idea of foreign policy revolves around the interests of Israel, And within Israel right now, we've got the most, one of the most belligerent Zionist governments that that nation has ever had. What, of course, isn't being reported in the mainstream media is that the magnitude of protests in Israel against the Israeli foreign policy and against the Israeli agenda with the Palestinians is enormous. Absolutely enormous. Which is why you've got the likes of Netanyahu, who are desperate to initiate a war with Iran so that Israel gets attacked and then they can unite the people because of the threat to their country. And yet more and more people within Israel are starting to see that this is outrageous. This is not the way they want to live. And of course, many of the Israeli citizens who have come into Israel from other countries are also now beginning to realize that they were recruited to become Israeli citizens under false pretenses. Because Israel is a very, very apartheid society. Very, very structured. And so there's massive unemployment, massive underemployment, not being reported in any of the Western media. And what we are seeing in the US presidential campaign, of course, is what it's coming down to is, will these candidates support Israel or not? And of course, Ron Paul appears to be the only candidate who's actually offering any counter, because he's the only candidate that isn't receiving a large sum of money from APAC, the America-Israel Public Affairs Committee. That's what it's going to boil down to. In the UK press, there is one voice of reason, Robert Fisk. I mean, Robert Fisk is a very, very astute journalist. He pushes the envelope as far as he dare. If he pushed it any further, he wouldn't get published. But you know, unfortunately, very few people, I think, read his articles. I mean, unless people are already of the opinion of Fisk, you know, which is basically, you know, what's going on here. You know, we need a cohesive policy to try and resolve the problems, not just keep supporting a belligerent Israeli foreign policy.
Who does he write for?
Well, Independent generally, but I mean, he writes in other publications as well. But generally, The Independent. He's a staff writer with The Independent. I mean, this is the voice of reason. And he gets a lot of criticism from, you know, the alternative community because he doesn't go far enough. But you know, we've got to be smart. At least there is a voice of reason in the mainstream media. If he goes any further, then he just would suddenly find that his articles are not being published. And this from today's Daily Mail, it's fictional. It's a work of fiction. And this always happens in the mainstream media as we have a ramp up to a war. And it's a fictional article. Mysterious explosions on a country estate, mortars trained on the royal box at the Derby. Well, I read this article because my family house is on the edge of Epsom Downs. And I happened to read this article, and the thrust of the central terrorist attack here is on the Queen on Derby Day at Epsom Downs, with a mortar attack launched from a house bought by some Iranians about 400 yards away from where my parents live. So I just called my dad and I said, Dad, you haven't had any Iranians sort of looking to buy your house with you. But this is the kind of bullshit that you'll see, because the vast majority of people, unfortunately, not you guys here, you wouldn't be here otherwise, but the vast majority of people, when they're reading the newspaper, they're not discerning between fact and fiction. You know, it's the same with the mainstream media on the TV. You know, that's why it's so easy to create these constructs, because you can literally just take, you know, a brilliant piece of film footage, and all you've got to do is put on the bottom that it's news, and the vast majority of people will believe it. So we've got an incredible situation here. We've got an economy that is in the fifth year of meltdown. The fifth year. Now, you would think that after 5 years, amongst all of the financial wizards on the planet that somebody could come up with a solution. Well, they have. Many of them have. But they're demonized. Do you know that you cannot get a PhD awarded from the London School of Economics if you write a thesis on anything other than fractional reserve banking and government taxation? Anything, any thesis that proposes any kind of alternative economic principle will be disregarded. This is how the peer review process works, to make sure that nobody gets too creative, that nobody really comes up with a solution that, you know, people might just go, oh my God, let's do that. Then you have the likes of Morgan Kelly, a brilliant economist in Ireland, professor of economics at the University College Dublin. And I first came across Morgan Kelly when I was doing a series of talks in Ireland 18 months ago with Jim Corr, where we were trying to explain, this is before the total collapse of the Irish economy, before Brian Cowan got voted out of office, and we were trying to explain to people exactly how things were going to unfold. And Morgan Kelly was writing articles. In fact, Jim and I used to joke that, you know, Morgan Kelly had to have been coming along to our presentations because he was basically writing what we'd been talking about. But I doubt he had. He didn't need to. I mean, it wasn't rocket science, but he was presenting the alternatives, and he had the credentials of Professor of Economics of University College Dublin. The articles were getting printed, but the articles were being printed, and then the comments were being printed alongside them. And the comments were coming from the bankers and the politicians and other academics who were all describing Morgan Kelly as a maverick. And even going as far as to dismiss him, and this is a brilliant one, as a Walter Mitty character. Walter Mitty character. I mean, the moment that you see anybody in the media described as a Walter Mitty character, you need to go and take a deeper look at what it is that they're trying to get across.
David Kelly.
Because this is a term of derision to literally get people to switch off and not take any further notice of what it is they have to say. Let me show you a short clip. Some of you will have seen this clip before, but let me show you a short clip of Nigel Farage a few weeks ago.
Co-president of the Europe of Freedom and Democracy, Nigel Farage, the floor is yours.
Well, here we are, on the edge of a financial and social disaster, and in the room today we have the four men who were supposed to be responsible. And yet we've listened to the dullest, most technocratic speeches I've ever heard. You are all in denial. By any objective measure, the euro is a failure. And who is actually responsible? Who's in charge out of you lot? Well, of course, the answer is none of you, because none of you have been elected. None of you actually have any democratic legitimacy for the roles that you currently hold within this crisis. And into this vacuum, albeit reluctantly, has stepped Angela Merkel. And we are now living in a German-dominated Europe. Something that the European project was actually supposed to stop. Something that those that went before us actually paid a heavy price in blood to prevent. I don't want to live in a German-dominated Europe, and nor do the citizens of Europe. But you guys have played a role. Because when Mr. Papandreou got up and used the word referendum, or Mr. Wren, you described it as a breach of confidence, and your friends here got together like a pack of hyenas, rounded on Papandreou, had him removed and replaced by a puppet government. What an absolutely disgusting spectacle that was. And not satisfied with that, you decided that Berlusconi had to go. So he was removed and replaced by Mr. Monti, a former European commissioner, a fellow architect of this Euro disaster, and a man who wasn't even a member of the parliament. It's getting like an Agatha Christie novel, where we're trying to sort of work out who's the next person that's going to be bumped off. The difference is we know who the villains are. You should all be held accountable for what you've done. You should all be fired. And I have to say, Mr. Van Rompuy, 18 months ago when we first met, I was wrong about you. I said you'd be the quiet assassin of nation-state democracy, but you're not anymore. You're rather noisy about it, aren't you? You, an elected man, went to Italy and said, this is not the time for elections, but the time for actions. What in God's name gives you the right to say that to the Italian people?
Thank you.
You've got quite a hand there.
Why do you think it is that... Why do you think it is that none of that ever appears on the British media? Yeah. Ever. The only way you're ever going to see any recording of Farage's presentations in the Parliament are on Russia Today. And of course that's a fringe channel. And Ofcom are doing their level best to remove the fringe channels. Press TV has gone because of course Press TV was ostensibly Iranian. So Press TV has had to go because you know, we're about to go to war with them. Next under the microscope is Russia Today and Edge Media.
Julian Assange is supposed to be on Russia.
Really?
In a month's
time. Can I ask
you one question? No, I'll take your questions later, okay? In Edge Media, I mean, we literally now have one of the owners who is pretty much full-time responding to Ofcom requests, questions, insinuations. Ofcom are desperately trying to find ways to shut down the alternative channels within the guidelines. And of course, what we have to be careful of is not handing the proverbial head to them on the silver platter. You know, which is why we have to be very, very careful. I mean, and it means that we have people within the alternative community who get very, very upset when comments they make are edited out. Yeah, you know, because we know what Ofcom are like. And basically, if we just go one step over the line, they'll use that as an opportunity to take us off air, take Edge Media off air. So do take a look at what Farage is putting out there, because you're never going to see this, ever, on the mainstream media. And ever since Nigel Farage had his near-death experience in the run-up to the British elections last year, when his plane, light plane, unfortunately... came down rather quicker than it was intended to. But basically, since that near-death experience, Farage doesn't give a damn, which is great. You know, basically, it's like just shoot from the hip and tell it like it is. You know, he's doing a wonderful job, and he really is telling it like it is. And of course, Russia Today has Max Kaiser. And you know, Max is also telling it like it is. And I know some of you have seen this clip before, but let me show you this, because this is a guy called Alessio Rastani. Who gave was invited to give an interview on the BBC, and now this is about 4 months ago now. And this had the BBC in absolute apoplexy. In fact, in the immediate aftermath of this interview, the BBC tried to claim that actually he was an imposter. He wasn't really a traitor. He was a hoaxer. But of course, it was pretty much very quickly established that was not the case at all.
And it's going to fall pretty hard. Because markets are ruled right now by fear. Investors and the big money, the smart money, I'm talking about the big funds, the hedge funds, the institutions, they don't buy this rescue plan. They basically, they know the market is toast. They know the stock market is finished. The euro, as far as they're concerned, they don't really care. They're moving their money away to safer assets, like treasury bonds, 30-year bonds, and the US dollar. So it's not going to work.
We keep hearing that whatever the politicians are suggesting, and admittedly it's all been rather woolly so far, isn't right. Can you pin down exactly what would keep investors happy, make them feel more confident?
That's a tough one. Personally, it doesn't matter. See, I'm a trader. I don't really care about that kind of stuff. I go with what the... If I see an opportunity to make money, I go with that. For most traders, it's not about, we don't really care that much how they're going to fix the economy, how they're going to fix the whole situation. Our job is to make money from it. And personally, I've been dreaming of this one for 3 years. I have a confession, which is I go to bed every night, I dream of another recession. I dream of another moment like this. Why? Because people don't seem to maybe remember, but The 30s depression, the depression in the 30s, wasn't just about a market crash. There were some people who were prepared to make money from that crash. And I think anybody can do that. It isn't just for some people in the elite. Anybody can actually make money. It's an opportunity. When the market crashes, when the euro and the big stock markets crash, if you know what to do, if you have the right plan set up, you can make a lot of money from this. For example, hedging strategies is one. Then investing in bonds, treasury bonds, that sort of stuff.
If you could see the people around me, jaws have collectively dropped at what you just said. I mean, we appreciate your candor. However, it doesn't help the rest of us, does it? All the rest of the Eurozone.
I would say this, listen. I would say this to everybody who's watching this. This economic crisis is like a cancer. If you just wait and wait thinking this is going to go away, just like a cancer, it's going to grow and it's going to be too late. What I would say to everybody is get prepared. This is not a time right now to wishful thinking the government is going to sort things out. The governments don't rule the world. Goldman Sachs rules the world. Goldman Sachs does not care about this rescue package, neither does the big funds. So actually, what I want to help people. People can make money from this. It isn't just traders. What they need to do is learn about how to make money from a downward market. The first thing people should do is protect their assets, protect what they have. Because in less than 12 months, my prediction is the savings of millions of people is going to vanish. And this is just the beginning. So I would say be prepared and act now. The biggest risk people can take right now is not acting.
Alessio Rastani, thank you very much for talking to me.
You dream about the economy at night?
I try.
There what you see is a trader in turmoil. Because, I mean, he's been trained, obviously, to do the best he can for his clients. I mean, that's how he makes his money. That's his job. I mean, his job is to stay ahead of the curve. But here was a guy basically saying, look, I want to help people. You know, I'm going to help myself first, of course. And I'm going to take care of my clients, of course. But I want to help people. I want to give people a heads up. And of course, you know, when the BBC and the financial community went into absolute hysteria trying to dismiss this guy, then it should have become pretty obvious to the critical thinker that this guy had more than a modicum of insight. And what he was saying is, I want to help people resolve this, because what's going on is like a cancer. And what I hope I've shown you over the last, you know, hour or so is that there is no desire to cut out that cancer. The strategy is to allow the cancer to strip out everything, to destroy everything, to asset strip the planet. So you can either just sort of ride with it and see where it goes, or you can take a little bit of initiative. Now, for a lot of people, they're not in a position to do very much except ride it out. But then hopefully, you know, they're going to start talking to people in their family and their extended family. And then when it does come, I mean, even you've got a situation today where people in your family or extended family may go, oh, don't be so bloody stupid. That's not going to happen. But then when it does, and they go, oh, my God, you're right. Then they're going to come back and say, okay, what do we do now? Because then they're going to want to start talking about what it is that they can do to avoid getting caught up in this mess. Well, in the first instance, let's finish this first session with some very practical aspects. Because, you know, as Alessio Rastani has said, within a year, the savings of millions of people will disappear. It will evaporate. It will effectively become worthless. And every time more money is pumped into the system, the money becomes increasingly worthless. That's where you end up with a situation where you need a wheelbarrow to cart the notes along to the bakers to get a loaf of bread. So what do you do to protect yourself against the worst of it? Well, in the short term, of course, the important things are food, water and shelter. And food and water, obviously, are very much at the top end of that. Because if this thing really does collapse, then ultimately it could well be that the government has to do what the Icelandic government did 3 years ago, when they announced to their people that nobody would lose their home, nobody would be evicted from their house because of the collapse of the economy. which takes away the first level of fear. The second statement they made was that nobody would starve. I mean, they really did make the observation, we are all in this together, and we'll make sure that nobody starves. So what they were doing was they were creating this 300,000 strong community to collectively dig their way out of this hole that had been created by the bankers. And we can't do that with 60 million, but we can start to do it with our families, our extended families, and then, you know, maybe extended into the community. So if you haven't been stocking up on food and water, I mean, if you don't have access to a natural water supply, I certainly don't, I'm reliant on mains water. So, you know, it would be the smart thing to start thinking about actually having a supply of water that you could use if, unfortunately, and it would be, I think, a relatively short time, because when the smelly stuff really does hit the fan, there may well be a few days or maybe even, let's say, 2 or 3 weeks of absolute chaos. But after that, communities really would start to pull together. That's a natural order of things. So, you know, we're talking about a short-term period where maybe there's going to be a necessity to pull the blinds, lock your doors, and just hunker down. Now, I hope to God that that doesn't actually come to be. Of course I do. But right now, there's a possibility. I mean, look at what's being written in the mainstream media. Mandelson even is talking about, you know, well, maybe we got it wrong. Maybe a free global economy isn't the way you're going to go forward. Maybe we are going to go into double dip. And everybody, of course, hopes that double dip means that it doesn't affect them, it just affects everybody else. Because, you know, depressions and recessions never affect everybody. It just becomes a larger percentage of the community. And that's the risk we're at, that percentage becomes unmanageable. You know, we've got a situation in Mid Devon, in Okehampton, where twice a month a charity comes along to dish out food parcels because two major employers in the town closed their gates on the first week of February last year. And a charity still comes into the town twice a month to distribute food parcels. This is in southwest England. It's not even in a depressed part of the country. So food and water. There's another possibility of food shortages for many, many different reasons. So, you know, take the opportunity where there's all the buy one, get one free deals. You know, it's buy one, stick one in the cupboard. It doesn't take long to build up a bit of a stock. And what it does is it takes away the fear, because you know in the back of your mind that if the worst comes to worst, you can shut your doors, pull your blinds, and you've got food and water for a period. And you and your family don't have to get caught up. You don't have to go foraging. You don't have to go looting. You know you've got a stock there. It's peace of mind. And then once you've actually got food and water, if you've got any liquidity, if you have money in the bank, particularly, you know, if you're in your senior years and you've worked long and hard to build up a nest egg, the great tragedy is that that nest egg is reducing in purchasing power at a phenomenal rate of knots. So what are you going to do with it? Well, if you're going to get your money out of the banks, my counsel would be to start doing it sooner rather than later, because there's not enough money in the banks to give everybody the money that they think they have in the banks, because the money doesn't physically exist. It exists on a computer screen, on a ledger. It doesn't physically exist. Why do you think the banks restrict you to taking £300 cash out in a day? That's why I converted the accounts I have to businesses accounts, where there's no limit. I can take as much cash out as I want. But if you have a personal account, £300, and then, you know, the banks have, my parents, you know, they said, oh, we've got a 45-day account. I said, 45 days? 45 days? So, yeah, they have to give 45 days notice, which is outrageous. So the last time I was with my father, we spent a couple of hours talking about, you know, the wisdom of a 45-day account. Look at where the smart money is going. This is the price of gold over 10 years. 10 years ago, it was $300, exactly. $300, and it had gone up from 250 in the September. This was the start of the climb of the price of gold. So gold today, this afternoon, was $1,725 an ounce. $1,725 an ounce. That is a return over 10 years of 475%. Anybody get that from a bank?
It's a robber.
Yeah, exactly. That's the only way you're going to get that kind of interest. Okay? 10 years. And every now and again, because with any kind of bull market, there's always correction periods. There's been three correction periods. One, two, and we're in the third one at the moment, in that 10-year period, but that doesn't impact on an underlying bull run. We look at 1 year, the 1 year return, and this has been a hell of a 6 months, the last 6 months, but for the 1 year return, from the end of January last year to this year, 27.8%. 27.8%. Now, for those of you who've seen my talks over the last two or three years, you know I've been talking about this on a regular basis. And the reason being is that because we are not taught in our culture how easy it is to own gold, to acquire gold, to own it, and how easy it is to sell it, the vast majority of people have no idea. So they need to hear this two or three times before they get their heads around the fact that it ain't smart to leave money in a bank. The banks use and abuse it and throw you the scraps and then make you feel grateful because they gave you 4%. 4%. 27.8% over the last 12 months, despite, you know, some interesting trauma, which we'll talk about in a second. But every year, for the last 10 years, the average return on gold has been 30%. 30% a year for 10 years. So we're not talking about a flash in the pan here. We're talking about a historical 30% per annum growth. And when I first started talking about this, which was about 5 years ago, people say, oh yeah, yeah, but Ian, 5 years, 30% over 5 years, so the growth has gone. You know, and I mean, there are still people to this day who occasionally will email me and say, oh my God, we wish we'd listened to you 5 years ago. Look at the last 60 days. And I show you this because you don't go into gold to make a quick buck. That's not what gold is all about. Holding gold is about protecting the purchasing power of your accumulated asset, your accumulated wealth. You know, back in at the end of the Second World War, it was said that one gold coin would buy you a reasonable quality suit. Today, one gold coin, a sovereign, will buy you a reasonable quality suit. A sovereign today is about £260. You can get a reasonable quality suit for £260. It holds the purchasing power. You know, a lot of people in this country still think there was a property boom between 2002 and 2007. No, there wasn't. There was smoke and mirrors. It was a total mirage. Back in 10 years ago, you needed 363 ounces of gold to buy the average property in this country. Today you need 163 ounces of gold. So in reality, property in this country today is worth 30% of what it was 10 years ago. And it's a mirage that's created to create the impression to get people to borrow money. Because when you create this impression that there's a boom going on, what you encourage people to do is buy a bigger house. Buy a second house, buy a car, buy a bigger car, buy a boat. And one of the reasons that the property market is still holding up right now and hasn't crashed where it should have crashed to is because the bankers have calculated that there's still some idiots out there amongst the middle classes who haven't been fleeced of everything they've got yet. And the way in which they're going to fleece them is they're going to convince them to either remortgage their own house, to lend their kids or give their kids the deposit, which goes to a bank,
Steve,
to get a mortgage. So the parents end up with a bigger mortgage, and the kids have a mortgage. And you know what mortgage means, don't you? Mortgage, death grip. It's brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant. So the reality is that the property prices will be artificially held up until basically the banks think that they've bled the middle classes as dry as they possibly can, or the middle classes have actually caught on to the fact they're being fleeced. The reality is, the average salary in this country right now the median salary. Let me say the median salary. The median means 50% of people earn more, 50% of people earn less. Anybody want to hazard a guess as to what the median salary is in this country? How much?
17 grand.
That's very good. It's very close. It's actually 19,200.
Without tax.
That's it, so you mean net. So you're about right. Yeah, 19,200. It's down, actually. It's down from 19,600 5 years ago. So that's the median salary. 50% of people earn more, 50% of people earn less. When you're earning 19,200, you ain't going to find the £28,000 deposit you need for the average house in this country. The only way you're going to raise that 28,000 is if you're fortunate enough to have parents that live in a house which they have equity in, and then they can remortgage and give you the money. I mean, it's a brilliant scam driven by the bankers. So over the last 60 days, what we've seen here with gold is absolutely zero. And in fact, anybody who bought gold here was probably having a coronary by about here. But their heart rate has calmed down a little bit because, you know, we're back. That's why I say, you don't go into gold for the short term. Because if you look at gold on a day-to-day basis, one day you're going to be in ecstasy and the next day you're going to have a coronary. It's a long-term hold. Here's the 30-day run, which is a little more interesting. So 30 days, anybody buying gold just 1 month ago would have got a return of 7.14%. in a month, which is about twice what a bank is offering over a year. Now, if you want to find out more about gold, and I mean, like I always say, don't take anything I say at face value. I'm not a financial advisor, but I can tell you, those people who have followed my advice have done a lot better than those who followed financial advisors over the last decade. Because financial advisors rely on the commission they get from the funds that they're required to sell. Because I offer this personal counsel with no axe to grind and no vested interest, it's just a straight explanation of what's occurring. But if you want to look at more of this for yourself, go to kitco.com, K-I-T-C-O, kitco.com. It is the commodity trader's Bible. And the beauty of gold is that there's no VAT and no capital gains tax. So apart from the small amount of commission, and if you're buying gold and anybody wants to charge you more than 5% commission, they're ripping you off. In other words, they're a retailer, not a dealer. You don't buy gold from a... You might buy a piece of jewellery from a retailer, but you don't buy gold from a retailer. You buy gold from a dealer. And if you want to go down that path, then speak to me later. This is this afternoon, 17:25 this afternoon, unless it went up.
What do you think of silver, Ian?
Silver's actually performed better than gold over the last decade, but silver's not so clean. Now you have to be a lot more knowledgeable, because some silver coins are subject to VAT. Some silver coins are not pure in their content. The beauty of gold, providing you're staying with sovereigns, half sovereigns, quarter sovereigns, Kruger Rands, American Eagles, China Pandas, Mexican Quetzals, it's pure. And the only thing you need to know, you don't have to be an expert, all you need to know is that you've got a gold coin, it goes on a scales, that's the weight, that's the Kitco price, one multiplied by the other, that's the value. No argument. And you know that you're going to pay 5% commission when you buy in a bull market, and no commission when you sell in a bull market.
And who do you sell?
With the same dealer you bought from. It's not as easy as going to the ATM, for sure. I mean, that's the issue here.
It's if you live in China.
Yeah, it is. They're actually issuing, they're setting up gold dealerships in all towns.
But do you put gold in a bank, or do you put
it on your... No. Why would you put anything in a bank? Because if the bank shuts their doors, you're not going to have access to anything. And by the way, Citibank, 18 months ago, sent out letters to all its customers advising them that it had the right to call a bank holiday without notice. So it's basically giving people notice that they could shut the doors. No. Listen, when you buy gold, the only person who needs to know you bought it is you. And the only person who needs to know where it is you.
Especially in America, right?
Well, especially in America. America's the only country in the world that has confiscated its citizens' gold, which he did once on March the 15th of 1934. Of course, not every American citizen actually handed their gold in, but that was under the threat of a $10,000 fine and life imprisonment. But what's happening right now in the US is a lot of people in the US are going to Mexico with cash and buying gold. And Goldman Sachs and the Federal Reserve are paying the US Immigration Service to beef up their border patrols in Mexico to try and prevent people smuggling gold back across the border. So what you've got in Mexico right now on the Rio Grande, the border service is paid for by the Federal Reserve, Goldman Sachs, and the pharmaceutical industry. And the pharmaceutical industry is there because pharmaceutical drugs, are so much cheaper in Mexico that a lot of people, especially elder people who need a lot of medication, they go across to Mexico to buy the drugs and bring them back across the border.
There's a new gold buying shop that's just opened in the high street.
If it's a gold buying shop in the high street, I wouldn't go anywhere near it. Listen, the bottom line is you go to Kitco, you see what the price is, you get on the phone to your gold shop, and if they're charging any more than 5%, they're ripping you off.
You sure there's no capital gains?
No, absolutely not.
We US citizens have to pay 28% now because of Obama. He put it in the health bill.
In the health bill, that's exactly correct. Actually, you don't have to pay it yet, but it is in the health bill. And the reason it was put in the health bill was because basically what Obama wanted to do, or his advisors wanted to do, was they wanted to create a potential revenue stream to fund this social health care if it got out of control.
Sure,
so,
it's
no,
now.
It's not in force, but it is on the statute book.
So it's not now?
No. But, I mean, the bottom line is, it's like a lot of legislation. It's on the statute books, but it's not enforced.
Because when I spoke to the American IRS, they said yes, that I would have to pay that back.
Oh, don't tell them. Yeah, I mean, the IRS are a whole bunch of people. Okay, I'm going to bring the first half of the... evening to a close with this, because I want to show you this. Some of you will have seen this before. This is a poster that was used in the EU. It was used in the EU during the referendums in France, the Netherlands, and in Ireland. And of course, the first referendums in France, the Netherlands, and Ireland all voted against signing up to the EU treaty. But in France and the Netherlands, their government said, well, thanks, but, you know, we don't really need your consent anyway. Ireland was a different ballgame because within their constitution, it is required that they have a referendum when power is handed away to a foreign entity, thanks to a wonderful Irish campaigner in the 70s by the name of Raymond Crotty. But this poster appeared throughout France, Netherlands and Ireland. Europe, many tongues, one voice. So a lot of symbolism contained within this single poster. First of all, of course, you recognise this?
Tower of Babel.
Anybody seen a picture of the Strasbourg Parliamentary Building?
It's that.
It's the Tower of Babel. So once again, yeah, we have prima facie evidence that the EU is a Babylonian entity. Catholic Church is a Babylonian entity. If you want to see or read more about the relationship between the Catholic Church and the EU, then just Google Peter Sutherland and St John's College, Oxford. He gave a speech on May the 15th, 2010, at St John's College, Oxford. And in the opening paragraphs of that speech, he talks about the relationship between the Catholic Church and the EU. Why do you think Tony Blair converted to Catholicism? It's the only way he can become president of the EU. So we have the Tower of Babel. We have the moat here. Now, you know the great seal on the back of the $1 bill, the separated capstone? Well, the separated capstone on the great seal represents the knowledge and the wisdom of the few never to be shared with the masses being represented by the body of the pyramid. Here, what we have is the Tower of Babel representing the capstone, i.e. the knowledge and the wisdom of the few never to be shared with the masses the other side of the moat. I won't even get into this. Okay, what we have here is we have the grey suits looking longingly across to the Tower of Babel. There's not a word in the English language to describe, well, not a polite word anyway, to describe the guys in the grey suits. So I'm going to use German word. And that word is Kapo. Kapo. These are the Kapos, the Kamppolizei. The word Kapo was coined by the National Socialists, the Nazis, when they established the Jewish ghettos. They didn't want to use their own resources to manage the ghettos, so they identified people within the Jewish community to effectively be the head honcho within the ghetto. And these were called the Kapos, the Kamppolizei. And these the Kamppolizei were given better accommodation, more food rations, access to better clothing. And they were also required to provide the Nazis with the lists of people to be shipped out of the ghettos to go to the camps. But of course, when the ghettos were emptied, and there was no longer any need for the Kamppolizei went exactly the same way as everybody else in the ghetto. These are the politicians, the bureaucrats, you know, those who like to think of themselves as being part of the community. But basically what they're doing, they've sold their soul in return for the lifestyle, the salary, the bells and the whistles. And they will carry out the whim of their masters the other side of the moat. The capo, the Kamppolizei. This is the hoi polloi, the masses. I know it's not in great focus here, but do you notice something about the way in which the people, the figures, are drawn there in that picture?
Blockheads.
Blockheads, exactly. These are the blockheads. Now this is a poster, this is a classic example of putting the information out there. It's basically like giving the people the finger and saying, you know what, you dumbasses? You know, we can put this right under your noses and you can't see it. It's the blockheads. Now there's one exception. There's one figure within those people there that isn't a blockhead. Can you see which one that is?
The baby.
The baby. Exactly, it's the baby. The baby. What this is telling us, what these guys know, is that every member of humanity is born into this world with the full range of human capability and capacity and everything that that entails. And if we achieve the capability to access that full range of our capability and capacity, these guys are totally screwed. So their challenge is to make sure that we don't achieve access to that full range of capability and capacity. And so from the point at which we enter this world to the point at which we effectively become an adult contributor to their construct, we become a blockhead. We become shut down. And what I'm going to introduce you to in the second half of the evening is some of the methodology, and it'll all fall into place for you as to how that's done. But I'm also going to share with you how we are breaking through that. We're all breaking through it. Many people don't yet fully realise what's happening, but it's happening on an increasing basis. And when I start to share some of this stuff with you in the second half of the year, you're going to go, oh my God, oh yes, it's going to fall into place. These guys know this is happening. This is why they're making more and more effort to shut us down, to keep us in blockhead mode. But they know that once we start to break out of it, there's no turning back. And that we just go from strength to strength. And that's why they're accelerating their agenda at a phenomenal rate, because they know the race is on big time. So let's take a short break so that you can have a smoke, have a leak. We got tea. There's some tea, some coffee, and see you in 15 minutes.
Where unknown forces strike the edge of ecology.